For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey everyone, Dr. Jason Old here, surfer, historian, world traveler, and your host of the Surfing Historian Podcast. This season, we'll be diving deeper into the nuanced world of surfing and examining the historical, cultural, philosophical, and even scientific elements of the sport we're all stoked on. So let's paddle out together and ride through the world of academia. This episode is sponsored by Saba Surf. Saba Surf is a hand-poured all-temperature surf wax company from Venice Beach, California. In fact, a portion of their profits go to supporting local artists, shapers, surfers, photographers, designers, environmental groups, and anyone else who makes cool stuff. Check them out at sabasurf.com and use promo code SURFHISTORY for 15% off their amazing hand-poured surf wax and their sweet apparel. Joining me today for an epic episode on the roots of California surfing culture is Dr. Patrick Moser. Patrick's a professor of writing and French at Drury University, and he's recently finished a biography on George Freeth titled Surf and Rescue, George Freeth and the Birth of California Beach Culture. Patrick was also the editor of the book Pacific Passages, an anthology of surf writing. And on top of that, he's collaborated with former surfing world champion Sean Thompson on two books, Surfer's Code, 12 Simple Lessons for Riding Through Life, and The Code, The Power of I Will. By the way, all these books are featured on the surfinghistorian.com homepage. Check them out. And while you're there, be sure to scoop up some of our killer merch too. That helps to support this awesome podcast. For today's episode, we'll talk about the history of California beach culture from 1907 to 1945, as well as how one goes about writing surf history in general, and the process of publication with a university press or a surfing magazine. I'm super stoked to have you on the show to share this information with our listeners. Patrick and I met at a conference at San Diego State University recently, so it was super cool to put a face with a name since I'd already been familiar with his work. But before we get started, I want to personally thank you, Patrick, as well as our listeners, for being part of this episode of The Surfing Historian.
Thank you, Jason. It's a pleasure to be here on your podcast, and I appreciate the invitation to talk about my research and George Freeth. And hello to all the listeners out there in podcast land who are interested in academic surfing.
And as I've told you before and a number of others, you know, your work has helped legitimize my work or inspired me to pursue, you know, this path of what we call critical surf studies. But you know, I don't want to go on and on about my stuff. I want to get right into your book. So Patrick, if you just wouldn't mind, who is George Freeth? And, you know, what compelled you to write about him?
So great question, starting off. George Freeth was a mixed race Hawaiian. His dad was English and his mother was also mixed race, as was his grandmother. Came from that Native Hawaiian tradition. So he was born at Waikiki, grew up there. And then he came to California several times, but the most important time was 1907, arrived in Los Angeles. And that began about 12 years in California. And he basically established the foundation of California beach culture as we recognize it today by combining surfing and lifeguarding. So what I mean by as we recognize it today is California beach culture has been around ever since people have lived on the coast of that state, even before it was called California. Obviously, you know, Native Americans were there. They had their own beach culture. But we didn't really know about it at the time. At the time of Freeth, nobody really knew about that culture. And we don't know much about it today. So the beach culture that I'm really writing about in the book is the beach culture that we recognize from Gidget to the Beach Boys and Dick Dale on through, you know, Baywatch. And what they have in common is surfing and lifeguarding. So I live and teach in Missouri. So if I were to say to one of my students, you know, what do you associate with California beach culture? Of course, what are they going to say? They're going to say, oh, surfers, you know, they're going to say lifeguards. They might say volleyball. Some of them might come up with the Beach Boys, who are actually coming in concert to Drury University in the fall here. If you can believe that, Mike Love and his crew. So that's the California beach culture that people know here. And so that's the beach culture that I'm tracing back the history of. And for me, it starts with George Freeth, this Hawaiian influence and this combination of surfing and lifeguarding that kind of triggers the interest in California beach culture.
Yeah, no, it's fascinating. And, you know, I really enjoyed the book. I'm pulling a quote here from Matt Warshaw, who, as you know, wrote The History of Surfing. And he has this to say about your book. Of course, you know, giving you praise for doing it. But George Freeth is an undeservedly forgotten figure in American cultural history. And then, of course, he goes on to say, and Patrick Moser is the right person to bring him forward. You know, I do agree that, you know, like Matt said, you did a great job on the book. But do you agree with that statement about George Freeth? I mean, is he a forgotten figure in American cultural history?
I think he largely is. I mean, I think as you had mentioned, you grew up or you surfed in Huntington Beach and had never heard about Freeth. I spent time, you know, I was born in Santa Monica and spent time in West LA as a teenager. I worked at the Redondo Beach Pier, and the only bust that I know of Freeth is at the Redondo Beach Pier. I didn't know who Freeth was. You know, I was a teenager. I was surfing, you know, in the right out there where Freeth used to give his surfing exhibitions. So I didn't know anything about him. I'd pass by that bust all the time. And so I think there are certain people within the surf community and some within the lifeguard community who understand, have heard his story and know who he is. But I think largely due to the influence of Duke Kanamoku, you know, such a larger than life figure. He was, you know, gold medalist, you know, multiple times over several Olympics, charismatic, great swimmer, you know, physically fit, attractive, hobnobbed with, people in Hollywood in the 1920s, the world ambassador of surfing. I mean, obviously, if you remember the surfer poll they did, you know, who's the most influential surfer of the 20th century? Obviously, it was Duke, number one. So I think Freeth sort of fell into Duke's shadow. He was there before Duke, a handful of years before Duke. Duke didn't really get to Los Angeles and stay until the early 1920s. He had visited a couple times. Freeth also died really young. You know, he was 35 years old. He died at a time when millions of people around the world, tens of millions of people around the world, died of, you know, the influenza pandemic of 1918, 1919. And on top of that, there was the millions of people who died in World War I. So he sort of, you know, got forgotten when he died in 1919. And then Duke arrived and you know, deservedly, you know, got a lot of the credit for, you know, spreading surfing and Hawaiian culture in California. So I think Matt is right. You know, people don't really know about Freeth. And I just thought, you know, here's a guy who's got such a great story. You know, I got into the book because I wanted to know more about him. I think Arthur Verge had the only academic study on George Freeth, and that was published, you know, two decades ago. And the little information that was out there was contradictory. You know, I had read that Freeth was the first surfer in California, and I started digging, and that turned out not to be true. And I read that he was the first, you know, lifeguard in California, and that turned out not to be true. And I heard that he won the Congressional Medal of Honor, you know, the highest honor a civilian can get in the United States. And that turned out not to be true. So as I started discovering this information, I thought, well, those things aren't true. What exactly were his accomplishments? You know, what exactly did he contribute so that people remember him, you know, surfers and lifeguards? Why do they remember this guy if none of that is true? And so I started, you know, just doing research and found out what his real accomplishments were, and, you know, started off really as a novel. I want to write a novel about George Freeth because I thought, here's a guy, a hero, who died young at a time, you know, during war and pandemic, and had a big impact. People still remember him in a certain group of people. I thought, oh, that's definitely stuff for a novel. And then I got about 125 pages into this novel, and it just wasn't working because I kept wanting to go back to the biography. You know, that's where the writing was taking me. So I stopped the novel and I said, I have to write a biography of this guy before I can write the novel because I want to know what the facts were. And then as I got into the biography, I discovered through all the nuts and bolts and getting into newspaper archives that, you know, there's a history here that is yet to be told. And that is the history, the beginning of California beach culture as we recognize it today.
Yeah, no, I was reading through it, through the book, you know, even in the intro, you mentioned, you know, I think it was three princes from Hawaii that were surfing in California in the, I think it was the 1880s. And then there were other surfer or people wave riding and, you know, in the 19th century, you know, sort of in and around that time as well. And then, you know, so I'm thinking, wow, what, you know, I didn't even know this stuff. And so it was really informative, and helpful to read, you know, that, you know, cause I was probably one of those people who thought, well, you know, Freeth introduced surfing to California and, you know, you helped me dispel that myth. And so I want to look at the history a little bit, because you do say when George Freeth arrived in Los Angeles from Honolulu in the summer of 1907, he brought a native Hawaiian perspective that celebrated all things aquatic. His surfing exhibitions not only showed how much fun one could have in the ocean, but they also helped convince local developers that riding waves could be used to fill their cash registers, as you put it. But I want to focus more on Freeth and the surfing, and maybe a little bit less on the developers. But what, when Freeth arrived, say in 1907, what did it look like? Did he bring a surfboard with him? Like, how did all of this, you know, in other words, that myth of him starting surfing, you know, why is that myth a thing? But more importantly, what did it look like when he showed up for these, you know, surfing exhibitions in 1907?
So another good question. He did arrive with a surfboard. He and a high schooler, Ken Winter, had been hired, you know, to give surf exhibitions in Venice. And so Freeth was interested in coming to Los Angeles. There were some people, they were part of the Hawaii Promotion Committee. Freeth kind of proposed this idea. It was in the air that Los Angeles was this boom town. It was growing. You know, that's where the future of Hawaiian tourism was going to be. That was according to the Hawaii Promotion Committee. The guy who was the secretary of that committee, H.P. Wood, had lived in San Diego for, I don't know, 15 years. And so when he was hired to work to be the secretary and the treasurer of the Hawaii Promotion Committee, he said, you know what? Southern California, and especially Los Angeles, is going to be, that's where we're going to draw most of our tourists from. And he was right. So it was in the air, and Freeth had never been to Los Angeles. And he sort of proposes, like, let me go there. You know, I'll give some surf exhibitions. And I don't think they ended up paying his way, but they did have connections in Venice with Abbot Kinney. So one of their agents worked in downtown Los Angeles, and he would give lectures every day on Hawaii, and he would give these slideshows. And so they got a hold of their agent, and they said, well, you know, why don't you work it out so that, you know, see if you can get a contract for Freeth and Ken Winter for the summer, you know, and Abbot Kinney was said, okay, you know, he's one of these developers in Venice at these resorts. And Venice was the closest resort to downtown Los Angeles. If you climbed on an electric trolley, you could probably be there in half an hour from downtown Los Angeles. And so Abbot Kinney was trying to pull people out. And so there's a couple of Hawaiians, you know. But in terms of surfing, one thing I hope people get out of the book is that George Freeth represents the continuity of Hawaiian culture. So there is this myth, not only that George Freeth brought surfing to California. I mean, I understand why that myth is there, because he did the most to renew interest. And he was there for almost a dozen years. He wasn't the first. But he stayed and he taught people, he gave lessons and exhibitions. So he gets the credit. But there were Native Hawaiians in La Jolla, in San Diego. There were Native Hawaiians in San Francisco who would come for a World's Fair, for example. And they would give exhibitions. It was for hotels. So they would, again, it was all, you know, to draw tourists out to the coast. But that shows you that surfing, in fact, did not die out. So there is that myth that surfing died out because Hawaiians were dying out, and Alexander Hume Ford, this white mainlander, arrived, and Jack London, they certainly put a spotlight on surfing and knew how to market it, but they didn't save surfing from dying. Surfing, you know, George Freeth gave lessons to Alexander Hume Ford at Waikiki, and he gave lessons to Jack London. So Freeth really represents this continuity of Hawaiian culture. Not a revival, but continuity. So he just continued that in California and started to spread this Hawaiian sport out to these towns. I mean, when he arrived, you know, there's probably 3,000 people in Venice, 3,000 people in Redondo Beach. These are small beach towns. People are just starting to live out there. But these resorts, also Abbot Kinney, Henry Huntington, they're also selling real estate. So they're bringing people out, not just to make money, you know, on whatever bathhouse, carnival, you know, they can. They had already bought land. And so they were selling land to people. And that's how they made their real money. So Freeth was there doing his thing, training lifeguards. So most of the people who moved into Southern California, and especially Los Angeles, came from the Midwest. And a lot of them, of course, didn't know the first thing about the ocean. So as Freeth is working at these resorts, and the resorts are popping up, they're in Venice. North of Venice, you have Ocean Park. North of Ocean Park, you have Santa Monica. You have south of Venice, you know, down in Long Beach. And then, of course, they have similar ones in San Diego as well. So Freeth is working at some of these places. People are coming out and people are drowning. So biggest accomplishment initially for George Freeth was to realize that there's this chronic problem of drowning, and people didn't understand what they could do to help solve that problem. They didn't really have the skills. Most lifeguards at the time would get in a boat and row out, and maybe they'd make it and maybe they wouldn't. You know how fast, of course, somebody can drown. Doesn't take long. And so Freeth was really instrumental in teaching lifeguards and showing lifeguards and people that you could swim out through storm surf and save people that way. So he gave people those skills, those lifeguarding skills to fix this, you know, help improve this chronic problem they have of people showing up at the beach, thousands of people, you know, July 4th, it's 95 degrees in downtown Los Angeles. What are you going to do? Well, you and, you know, 30,000 other people are going to hop on these network of trolleys that Henry Huntington built across the LA Basin, and you got to go to someplace cooler. So that's Long Beach, that's Venice, that's Redondo Beach, that's Santa Monica. Thousands of people on the beach. And all they've really got for people by way of lifeguarding is these lifelines that would, you know, they have one post stuck in the sand, another one out in the surf, and you just hang on to it, which is fine if the surf, you know, surf isn't big. But any kind of swell rolls through, you could easily knock somebody off. You know, riptide currents pull them down, riptide take them out, and they're gone. So, you know, that was the first thing Freeth sort of recognized. Hey, you know, I can help here. And I think maybe that's one of the reasons why he stayed for so long. You know, why didn't he go back to Hawaii after he became famous? He could have gotten a job there, no problem, doing what he did in California, giving surf exhibitions, lifeguarding. But I like to think that he saw a need for somebody with his skills. So not just lifeguarding, but this native Hawaiian perspective that I refer to is, you know, the surf zone is dangerous and you got to respect it, but it's also a lot of fun. You can surf there. You can body surf. You can have fun in the waves. You don't have to be afraid of it. So he started, and maybe his biggest influence was how many people he gave swimming lessons to, right? Thousands of people across the 12 years from Los Angeles down to San Diego, kids and men and women, teenagers, all walks of life. He gave swimming lessons in the ocean, in the pools where he worked. So creating that foundation so people didn't have to be scared of the ocean, taught his lifeguards to surf so they'd be better lifeguards. So really just on many layers, many aspects, he helped build that foundation to make California beach culture a reality, because you're not going to get California beach culture. People are scared of the ocean and they don't want to go on.
Save big money at Menards. Let the fresh air in and keep the bugs out with replacement screen for your doors and windows from AdForce. It's easy to install, durable against the elements, and comes in a variety of types to suit your needs. Repair your screens today with a roll of replacement screen on sale through May 5th. And check out more great deals happening now in our weekly flyer on Menards.com.
Save big money at Menards.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Yeah, no, and that was one thing you pointed out in the book as well. And, you know, looking at this sort of, As you talked about the ocean, the riptides and the undertows, it was as mysterious as it was deadly. A good buddy of mine is an LA County lifeguard. So we've had some conversations about Freeth as well. And one of the things I wanted to ask you about regarding the lifeguards actually and property and these developers was something he mentioned to me. And I was just kind of curious to get your thoughts on is, he was saying that as these beaches started to become more developed, the places that had lifeguard stations or lifeguard towers or lifeguards on duty, I should say, the land prices were higher. Is that true?
Eventually that's true. I think the first lifeguards worked in California at the resorts, right? Because the resorts, drowning is bad for business. Let's just put it bluntly. So they started these volunteer lifeguard organizations first and then paid lifeguard. The resorts wanted to protect the people who came out there. So lifeguards sort of grew up around the resorts. As far as land prices, I think it was relatively cheap. I mean, if you go into West LA in 1907, 1908, when George Freeth was there. I mean, if you took a trolley, you know, from, you know, Venice down to Redondo Beach, you might cross Manhattan Beach and Hermosa Beach, which today are, you know, full surf towns. And at the time, basically, they were agricultural land. You know, people had sheep on them and they were growing wheat and barley. These huge sand dunes. So coastal property was not expensive. I think probably what happens is as California starts to build highways along the coast and create access, Pacific Coast Highway, for example, that starts a land boom. So that really happens in the 1920s and 1930s. So as highways start to snake out of Los Angeles and San Diego, as the state starts to connect its major urban centers, people have access to the coast, and that's where they want to live because it's not as developed. So people of color, you know, people in the lower socioeconomic range were excluded. Obviously, people with money bought those up, especially white people. So you had, for example, Freeth had a famous rescue in December of 1908, where he saved seven Japanese fishermen in one afternoon. So that's what he got this United States gold life-saving medal for. And that was under the U.S. Department of Treasury. So he got that medal. The fishermen that he saved that day, they were living up north of Santa Monica out by the Long Wharf. So they had a little town right there on the beach. That whole town got bulldozed. It was called Maikura, and then they named it Freeth after George Freeth saved seven of the fishermen. They renamed the town after him. But when the highway started getting out there, they said, well, you know, this is prime real estate land. They just bulldozed that whole town. You know, any kind of habitations that were there, they just got rid of them. And it was basically, you know, you could just go there and squat. There's squatters' rights. They wanted people to live in that area, but, you know, they mostly had to be white people. So as California beach culture begins to develop, beginning with Freeth and then on through the 20s and 30s, it develops mostly for young, you know, for white people. So people of color were excluded. Of course, as you know, there were the two African-American beaches, Bruce's Beach and Manhattan Beach was, you know, I'll say, I think what they say is that African-Americans were less likely to get hassled there. And then, of course, the beach up at the bottom of Pico Boulevard in Santa Monica, sometimes known as the Inkwell. So they had African-American communities who lived right there that used the beaches. But then as beach culture developed, private beach clubs in Santa Monica, African-Americans were excluded from those properties.
Okay, yeah. And that, you know, that makes a lot of sense, sort of, you know, tracking the evolution of the development of coastal California for sure. And that was something Dan Reinemann and I talked about a little bit, just, you know, his work in coastal management. So it's really interesting to get that, you know, your perspective on how that evolution took place as well. And, you know, I do want to talk about the evolution of this sport away from something associated with, let's say, darker skin Native Hawaiians to a highly masculine, white masculine sport. But first I actually want to come back to something that, you know, something from the book, but something that Jack London is always quoted with saying, and just kind of pick your brain on that. But, you know, you say in the book that Freeth became a catalyst for transforming the popular imagination about the beach, which, you know, you've already articulated that between surfing and lifeguarding and training people in swimming and surfing. And he showed Southern California that surfing was not just a royal sport, as Jack London wrote in the summer of 1907, practiced by Native Hawaiians on distant shores, but something their children could do at the local beach in their own way. And so my question for you is more so about Jack London's quote, because it's my understanding, you know, and I've heard that quote multiple times, that, you know, surfing was the sport of kings and whatnot. But it's my understanding that it really wasn't. It was a sport that was heavily intertwined with all Native Hawaiian culture. So Do you know why, you know, could you speak to maybe the reasoning behind Jack London making a quote like that? Was it to create more of an allure around surfing, or what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think that's perfectly right. As you say, surfing was practiced by, you know, Hawaiian royalty, kings and queens and everybody else, from commoners to the very top. So that's, you know, been well known. So I think you're right. You know, just Jack London probably got most of his information about surfing from Alexander Hume Ford, and Alexander Hume Ford was trying to market Hawaii and Waikiki especially. Alexander Hume Ford wanted white people to move to Hawaii and balance out this huge Japanese population. So Hawaii was a U.S. territory, which meant that everybody could vote. And so people like Alexander Hume Ford and others were worried that, well, you know, what about the white vote? So they were purposely trying to get white people to immigrate to Hawaii and balance out that political, growing political power of the Japanese, you know, Americans. So they said, well, let's use surfing. Alexander Hume Ford said, this is something, you know, you can only learn surfing. You can only learn to surf at Waikiki. So you need to come here, and there's lots of benefits. So it was a marketing device. It's also interesting that, so Jack London probably just said, okay, you know, the sport of Hawaiian kings, it sounds great. But it's also, when you connect surfing to Hawaiian royalty, you're also saying this is something that kind of belongs in the past. You know, let's associate surfing with Hawaiian royalty, not democracy, you know, not sort of, you know, white American culture. So it's an interesting, you know, one of the issues and the stereotypes that Hawaiians have fought, you know, for a long time, was this idea that they are people who belong, you know, in the past, that it's really this sort of white American culture, technology, and all of that, that that is where it's at in the Hawaiian Islands. And so oftentimes you'll get illustrations and references to Hawaiians as, you know, they were important, but those people are really people of the past. When you look at films of the 1930s, you know, those South Seas Islands films, adventures, you always get, you know, Native Hawaiians portrayed as these pagan tribal people, you know, the way they dress, the way they talk. So associating surfing with Hawaiian royalty maybe falls into that stereotype a little bit, but certainly Jack London was, you know, trying to sell his story and make a buck.
Yeah, and so there really was this appropriation of the sport, and it ultimately took on a very white masculine character, and then that emanated out of California. Would you mind sort of walking myself and the listeners through that evolution, how it went from this sport, say, introduced by, well, sorry, not introduced by Freeth, but certainly helped spread the stoke, let's say. Freeth did that. And then, of course, Duke Hanamoku comes along and certainly adds to that stoke and popularity and the proliferation of surfing. But when does it begin to take on this, let's say, white masculine character, that when people think of surfing and the surfer dude, quote unquote, they think of this, you know, bushy blonde hair like the Beach Boys song? So when did that happen?
So, yeah, it's unfortunate that evolution, because as you said, with Freeth, I mean, Freeth was light skinned, but everybody knew he was Hawaiian. So he brought that Hawaiian perspective. Not only, you know, it's a lot of fun, you know, to go surfing and to play in the waves, but it was open to women, you know, it was open to children. If you look at the beaches of 1907, 1908, the women are head to toe in their bathing costumes, which were basically like dresses, very Victorian. So that was dangerous also, because once those bathing costumes got wet, you know, they're made of wool, they would just drag people down. So it was dangerous. So, but Freeth, you know, taught women how to swim, and he taught them how to dive, and he taught them how to surf. He was very open because of his native Hawaiian perspective and his background, and the Hawaiian culture of, you know all of the stories of Hawaiian women have always been part of surfing and aquatic history. Many women in myths and legends, you know, lots of Hawaiian women feature in those prominently. And, you know, the kings and the queens, famous queens, were great surfers. So Freeth brought that to California. And then Duke also, you know, he taught women how to surf. He taught them how to swim. So both of those guys brought this Hawaiian perspective to California, but it didn't stick. Well, why didn't it stick? Well, what happens in the 1930s, late 1920s and 1930s, is that California starts to develop its lifeguard organizations. The city of Los Angeles begins, and then Los Angeles County, and then Santa Monica. So who are allowed to be lifeguards? Well, only white males, right? So it's this combination of only white males can be lifeguards. This, again, 20s and 30s. And then only white males are allowed to be in the surf club. So if you're a member of the Palos Verdes Surfing Club, there were no women in that club. If you were a woman and you wanted to surf, you had to form your own clubs. And some women did form surf clubs. There were at least two that I knew of in the 1930s, that I know of in the 1930s. So it was very white. It was very male. There were no women in the surf clubs or in the lifeguard organizations. There were no people of color in the surf clubs or the lifeguard organizations. There's one exception. The first African-American lifeguard was John Tabor during the war in 1942. But other than that, the first African-American lifeguard isn't hired until the 1960s in LA County. And the first female lifeguard, not until the early 70s. So what happens, Tom Blake's hollow paddleboards become institutionalized as life-saving equipment. So the lifeguards are trained on those paddleboards that they also use as surfboards. So that combination of surfing and lifeguarding that Freeth began continues in the 1930s, but it's really only young white males who are really trained on those craft. And so the pictures that you see of the lifeguards at the time, all white males. Most of the surf clubs, right, all white males. So that's really where it happens. And then because people of color and women are not allowed to be lifeguards, they're not trained on the paddleboards and the surfboards. So that has a lasting impact on people of color surfing in California, right? We know that the Black Surfers Association doesn't really start until maybe the late 60s, early 70s. So there's definitely a negative long-term impact by the decisions that were made in the 1920s and 1930s about who were allowed to be lifeguards and who were allowed to enjoy this coastal space that was opening up for white Californians.
Yeah, and that makes a lot of sense. I mean, even, you know, even on our website, surfinghistorian.com, you know, I've highlighted a number of organizations that are not only empowering women of color, but encouraging them to get out and surf, you know. And so one of those is Brown Girl Surf. And there's a number of others. And but, you know, the story you're telling of this evolution into a white male surfing, evolution into a white male sport, really mirrors what was going on in Australia at the same time too, with a lot of the beach clubs and the lifeguarding and all of that. And so that does make a lot of sense. And I thank you, for helping me better understand that, as well as, you know, the listeners. But I do have a bit of a hypothetical question for you. What do you think Freeth would say about today's surfing culture? Be it, you know, in places like Malibu or Santa Monica or elsewhere in California, and even globally, do you think he would be surprised to see how it's proliferated across the planet? Or would he have been like, yeah, I assume that would happen?
Well, it's hard to say. I think he would be pleasantly surprised. You know, there is a Hawaiian perspective that really takes this idea that the more people surf, the better. You know, yeah, the waves are crowded, but it's a good thing if people are out paddling in the water. And I mean, it's probably better for the environment. You know, people become more aware of things like pollution and crowding and coastal access. So I think he would be happy, you know, with that proliferation. I think he'd be happy with the diversity that you have in surfing. I think he'd be really proud of the Hawaiian traditions, you know, both in surfing and in lifeguarding. I mean, you see who the Hawaiians are that are, you know, not Carissa Moore, you know, on the female side, and John Florence, for example, Zeke Lau. So you have great representatives on the world tour, and then in lifeguarding as well. So lifeguarding and surfing really start to separate sometime in the 1950s, you know, post-World War II. For the first 50 years of California beach culture and surfing's life, surfing and lifeguarding were, you know, they were twins, right? So the best lifeguards were always the best surfers and vice versa. You can start with George Freeth and Duke, and then in the 1930s, 20s, you have Tom Blake and Pete Peterson. All those guys were lifeguards. And then post-World War II, you know, you've got Greg Knoll, you've got Tommy Zahn, you've got Mike Doyle on through, right? So all those guys were lifeguards. And then it starts to split, but not in Hawaii, right? I mean, look at the latest winner of the Eddie, right? Luke Shepherdson. He won the Eddie. Like, he is a lifeguard himself, right? So I think Freeth would have been proud of that. And I ran into a North Shore lifeguard who I was visiting, doing some research for the Freeth book. And he said, wow, George Freeth was riding a motorcycle 100 years ago. Like, he used a motorcycle on the beach. George Freeth was actually the one who developed the motorcycle for rescues. And he said, we use those today. So he really saw a connection between himself and George Freeth. So I love that the lifeguards, their organization. I mean, Freeth would be so happy with the way lifeguarding. I mean, you look at LA County, it's the biggest probably lifeguard organization in the world. There's hardly any drownings in Los Angeles, right? Because of the effectiveness of that life-saving organization. When you think about, you know, the thousands and thousands, hundreds of thousands of people who visit the beaches every year, very, very few drownings. And, you know, that's the kind of thing that Freeth was trying to institutionalize, but didn't quite get off the ground.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. And, you know, you mentioned the Eddie. What a beautiful story. And, you know, shout out to Carissa Moore as well. You know, we have her organization featured on the website as well. You know, they're that aloha spirit, you know, and you really do see that. You know, I was recently on the North Shore of Oahu as well. And I was there during the Eddie, actually. And it was pretty impressive. And just, you know, to sit as you're talking about riding the motorcycle and Freeth and in the modern day, you know, North Shore lifeguard, you know, I'm sitting there watching Pipe, you know, particularly as the swells building for the Eddie. And I'm, you know, I'm thinking to myself, like, man, these guys really put themselves in harm's way. And, you know, so yeah, absolutely. I think you're spot on. And, you know, I'd probably have to agree that Freeth would probably have a big smile to see that legacy. For sure. I do want to come back to California surfing, you know, kind of segueing away from Freeth and that legacy of surfing. You mentioned something that, you know, it made me think a little bit about, but California didn't declare surfing as an official sport until 2018. And that just seems very delayed. Was there a reason behind that?
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Save big money on your outdoor project now at Menards. We have everything you need to keep your outdoor power equipment running smooth, so you can keep that lawn in tip-top shape or enjoy some time on your boat. Right now, all FVP, lawn and garden, and marine batteries are on sale through May 5th. Check out our entire selection of FVP batteries today and view our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals.
Save big money at Menards.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Yeah, it's, I think probably, you know, surfing, because of California beach culture, has a superficial reputation. You know, Baywatch and Pamela Anderson, the Beach Boys. California surfing is considered to be pretty superficial. You know, the blonde hair, the sandy brain dopers, you know, the Spicolis of the world. That's how people imagine Californians or Southern Californians. So maybe they finally realized that, you know what, this has a serious economic impact, you know, like $1 trillion that people spend along the coast in California every year. I think it was a state assemblyman from Torrance who put it forward up at in Sacramento, and Governor Brown finally signed it in. But I think maybe there was that delay just because of the superficial image that begins in the 1930s with people associating surfing with California's identity. But at some point, it's like, you know, this is serious. This has a serious economic impact, and we want to support it.
Yeah, no, and like I said, I was sort of shocked at the date with it being, you know, 21st century. And so, but yeah, you know, it's nice to see California recognizing a sport that is very much, you know, essentially intertwined with its reputation. And so, I know you've written a number of other books, so I want to drift away from this George Freeth book, which again, I've really enjoyed. And, you know, like I said, all of your work is, and a number of others, has really inspired me and helped me realize that, you know, we do have a very serious field that we work in critical surf studies in our own respective fields as well. But, what are some of the other books that that you've published on surfing? I think there was two you published with Sean Thompson. Would you mind filling in the listener with a little bit about why or how you wrote those books?
Sure. So I was at one of Glenn Henning's conferences out in California. He had the Groundswell Conference, and Glenn Henning, of course, is one of the founders of the Surfrider Foundation. And so Sean was giving a talk. Glenn Henning always asks the question, which is a question that I always liked, which is, what are you doing for surfing? You know, how are you giving back? And I always liked that. So Sean was talking at this conference. Uh, he was, he came up with the Surfer's Code. It was this, he was talking about how that, you know, he would give out these cards. He would, you know, Sean sells apparel at that time, and I think he still sells apparel. And so he had this Surfer's Code card and was just, you know, here are 12 things that that a surfer, you know, part of the Surfer's Code. I will always paddle back out, you know, I will never turn my back on the ocean. So he was talking about how that code came to be. You know, he went down to the surf contest at Rincon and Glenn said, you know, kids are going to be there. Give them something that, you know, they can take home with them. So Sean's like, well, maybe I'll give them some clothes, you know, a shirt. And then he thought, no, I'm going to make up this code. And he put it on this plastic card and he handed it out and it just became really popular. So he's talking and I'm sitting next to my wife, Linda. And she said, you know, that'd make a really good book. And I'm like, you know, the light bulb went off. And so Sean and I got together and I proposed the idea. And that was our first book. And it was called Surfer's Code, I think, 12 Lessons for Surfing Through Life. And that was published in 2006. So we did that, and that did really well. What I basically would do was for each one of those 12 code lessons, I would just draw out the story behind it. Then we did a second book that was really geared towards young adults. That was also called, you know, The Code. And that we did that book because when the Surfer's Code first came out in 2006, Sean's 15-year-old son, Luke, or not Luke, I'm sorry, it's his other son now. His son died accidentally. And like I said, he was only 15 years old. Right when the book came out, and that was devastating. And so we wanted to do something for, his name was Matthew. We wanted to do something for Matthew. Sean felt very strongly about it. So we took some of those stories and reworked them. We added a whole host of other stories, geared it towards that crowd, you know, teenagers, 15-year-olds, you know, kids who are having, even today, like mental health issues. Suicide rates are really high, all kinds of issues post-COVID. So Sean felt strongly about writing a book that would help that age group with, you know, adulting type of decisions. So we wrote the second book, and that's called The Code. So those were the two books I did with Sean, and it was great to work with him. You know, Sean has just got a great, you know, so many great stories, traveled the world as a world, you know, champion surfer, grew up in South Africa under apartheid and then moved, you know, to the States and became an American citizen, still heavily involved in the Surfrider Foundation and all kinds of, you know, still surfing. And so it was great for me. I felt fortunate to work with him and to listen to his stories.
Yeah, and those, you know, I know you already know this, but those books, of course, are featured on our website. And, you know, there's a lot of, I know we've already, you know, I've already mentioned it, but also on the website are a number of nonprofit organizations that are helping people that are dealing with mental health issues and a whole host of other things. So, yeah, I'm very grateful for, you know, all of these individuals around the world, you guys as well, contributing to, you know, I always kind of say like going beyond the waves, you know, it's, you know, we all love surfing and it's certainly a healthy activity, but I do believe through these sort of platforms and through writing and through these events, we can create a network to make the world a better place as well. And, you know, and so having said that, I do, you know, we've talked a lot about your books, but I'd just like to know how you went about publishing them. You know, what's the process? Like, you know, how does one go about publishing a book Surf and Rescue?
So that book was really geared towards a, you know, university press. So I teach at a university. It's really, you know, I teach exclusively undergraduates. So my book is really geared towards the undergraduate curriculum. So those are, you know, some of the audience I had in mind, my primary audience. Obviously, I wanted, you know, people at large who are interested in California history, surf history, history of lifeguarding, to be interested in well, but I wanted it to be challenging for, you know, for college students, anybody that age who's interested in history. And, you know, in terms of being authoritative and reliable in its research, and yet at the same time to also be open to a broader audience, because I think you're right, you know, it's nice to be able to surf and jump in the water, but you know, we can do better in this world in a lot of different ways. So some of my books, I try to show some of the exclusions that happened in the past, unfortunately, and maybe how we can do better today. I think we can always do better. You know, we can live up to those ideals of living in a democracy and making this world, including the surf, you know, a more equitable place. So my first step really was to do some research. So which universities publish what I was writing? So I was writing a biography. I was writing a sports biography. So it was really those two things. So there is a, you know, if you did some research, there is a, it's the, there's a worksheet out there I found online by the Association of University Presses, and it was a subject area grid. So they listed all the university presses and the subjects that they published in. So all I had to do was go down which universities publish sports history and biography, you know, and maybe sort of, you know, Hawaiian culture or minority studies or things like that. So I just kind of took the two or three basic topics in my book and looked around to see who published works on them. So it was University of Illinois Press, who I ended up going with, but University of California Press also, University of Arkansas Press. So these presses have sports and society. They have different, you know, series that they publish their books. So that was the way that I went about it. And then they will give you on the websites, if you go to the University of Illinois Press, they will give you all the information you need about how to put together a book proposal, what they're looking for. These are the questions to answer, you know, and so you can kind of go down the line and see what their requirements are. And then you put the proposal together, and then you send it off. It'll tell you which, you know, editor to contact. You contact them, send them a little, you know, are you interested in this? Here's my proposal. And then you see where it goes. So that was a process that I did for the George Freeth biography. And then I have a follow-up book that's coming out next spring as well. And it was the same process.
Yeah, thank you for that. You know, as you know, I personally appreciate it as somebody looking to publish my dissertation. And, you know, I'm sure there's listeners out there that are hopefully inspired by the fact that they can even write about surfing. But now we've given them, or you have actually, a bit of a roadmap in terms of, you know, where to go and how to hunt down the right publisher. But, you know, Patrick, thank you so much. You know, I've really appreciated the book. I appreciate our conversation. And, you know, with that, I want to just go ahead and give you the last word.
Okay, well, thanks so much. I've appreciated the conversation as well, and the thoughtful questions. I liked your comments as well, very incisive. And I always learn, you know, from everybody I speak with. So I like doing these talks because I learn just as much, you know, as hopefully that I might be sharing my research with others. So it's a great opportunity for me. And as I said, I'm just finished a second book. So that will be coming out with the University of Illinois Press next spring. That's the planned date. It's called Waikiki Dreams, How California Appropriated Hawaiian Beach Culture. And basically it picks up where George Freeth left off. So he died in 1919. This book tracks California beach culture from 1920 through World War II and kind of takes us through the Duke years, you know, 1920s, the 1930s with Palos Verdes, you know, Malibu, and where else? What's the other center? So, you know, Santa Monica area and San Onofre, of course, the surf clubs. And then what happened to California beach culture during World War II and the impact of World War II on the surfers and lifeguards. So it was a great project, and hopefully gets out there and people sort of link it to what this George Freeth book is. You know, this history of California beach culture, I think this is a period that is not really well known, you know, the pre-Gidget period. You know, that first 50 years from like 1950 to 1957, beginning with Freeth and ending with, you know, the post-World War II crowd. So I've enjoyed doing research in that area and trying to share my research with other people. So I appreciate the invitation today.
If you enjoyed my conversation with Patrick about the roots of California surfing culture, I'd like to invite you to check out my next episode, where I'll be joined by Brazilian surfer and journeyman, Adrian Kojan. Adrian and I will be talking about his surfing motorcycle foray through Latin America in the late 1980s, as well as his recent reboot of that very same trip in 2022 and 2023. Adrian's trip in the late 80s took him through, among other places, Nicaragua, at the height of the Contra War. We'll be chatting about his experience in Nicaragua at that time, as well as other adventures he had during this unforgettable trip. If hearing these types of surf stories gets you stoked, then this will be an episode you won't want to miss. We also want to take a moment to thank Saba Surf again for sponsoring this episode. Don't forget to check them out at sabasurf.com. And while you're there, use promo code SURFHISTORY for 15% off your purchase. Thanks for joining us for another episode of The Surfing Historian. If you're stoked on these conversations, be sure to share, like, and subscribe to never miss an episode. And don't forget to check out our killer merch at surfinghistorian.com. Proceeds go to help keep this amazing podcast going strong. Until next time, stay stoked.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Save big money now on new siding from LP Smart Side at Menards. Update and beautify your home with your choice of 13 timeless colors of pre-finished engineered siding. It's durable and includes a Sherwin-Williams factory finish paint warranty that means no painting for years to come. View our entire selection of siding from LP Smart Side today. And don't forget to check out our flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money at
Menards. Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.